We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
This is Focus. Glad to have you with us for this second hour of the show. And in this part of the program, we'll be talking about genetic testing. Last month, Walgreens, which is the nation's biggest network of drugstores, announced that it would start selling over-the-counter genetic tests that would indicate a person's tendency for a range of inherited diseases. When that announcement was made, it was a big story across the country. It drew immediate questions from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration on a kind of a regulatory basis. But also, a lot of healthcare groups said that even if the test results were accurate, that people would need a lot of help in deciding what those results that they would get back actually mean for them. In this part of the program, we'll be talking a bit about genetic testing and what it is and who should consider being tested and who should do the testing and then what kind of additional information people need to have as they think about those results. And our guest for the program is Dr. Ellen Wright Clayton from Vanderbilt University Law School. She is at Vanderbilt a professor of genetics and health policy, of law, and also of pediatrics. And in her work, she's interested in law and genetics and also in the intersection of law, medicine, and public health. She has published widely in these areas. She's also advised the National Institutes of Health, along with some other federal and international bodies, on a range of topics, including children's health and also the ethical conduct of research that involved human subjects. And she's been good enough to give us some time here this morning. She's joining us by phone, and questions are welcome. People want to participate in the conversation, they can do that very easily by calling us. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. Also, we have the email if you'd like to send your comment that way. Write will-talk, just like it sounds, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions, comments are certainly welcome. And Dr. Clayton, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I am fine, thank you. And how are you?
I'm doing great.
Good. Appreciate you talking with us today. The thing that really piqued our interest, got us thinking about having this discussion, was indeed a lot of the reporting that was reported in our Chicago Tribune here, and I know across the country, a lot of papers picked up on this this plan that Walgreens was going to do to sell these test kits. And they were kits that you could go, the plan was you could go to Walgreens and get a kit that would indicate your risk for quite a range of things, things like breast cancer and colorectal cancer and diabetes and lung cancer and Parkinson's disease. And that's just a few, a long list of these. And as I said, right away, the FDA said, well, wait a minute, we're not quite so sure about this. But their concern was really regulatory. Other people, though, said, well, we're not really quite sure that that this is such a good idea. For the following reason, that is, well, when people get back their results, what are they going to do with that? How are they going to think about that? Will anybody be there to help them think about what exactly that means? Can you talk about that part of it?
Oh, sure. Well, the fact of the matter is that, you know, for almost every kind of genetic variant that affects our health, it's not the only thing that's involved, and that, you know, what's involved depend on your environmental exposures, your life history, your family history, and I mean more than just, you know, what genes you get, but just whole kinds of things about health. And so you get a simple gene result back, and then, but there's much more information that's needed to try to interpret what it means for the individual. Almost always the results you get are probabilistic. And what I mean by that is that they not only don't even tell you whether you're going to get sick, but they don't tell you that if you're going to get sick, when you're going to get sick. And so, you know, this is very complex information to try to understand. And, you know, we actually have a fair amount of experience with this in the last decade because a number of companies have been offering a variety of genetic tests online, the so-called direct-to-consumer testing companies. And what we found is that it's complicated to understand. It leads to people going to geneticists to try to figure out what it means because their family physicians don't know what it means. And so it's sort of like the culmination of what we've actually been dealing with for the last decade, to actually take it off the computer and onto the shelf of Walgreens. And I think that just really finally caused, you know, enough concern for the FDA to come in and say, gee, maybe we're not ready for prime time yet.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, that this idea, not necessarily new, maybe this way of selling the test is new, but the idea is not new. And also maybe we should say that based on the concerns stated by the FDA, then I think Walgreens said, they at least said we'll put this plan on hold. I don't know what exactly over the long term that's going to be, but that does make one wonder whether, in fact, we should expect to see more and more of this kind of direct consumer marketing of genetic tests.
Oh, I think you can guarantee it. Although it's the case that about a week and a half ago, the FDA sent a letter to some of the companies that offer direct to consumer testing, you know, asking them for more information about what they were doing and sort of beginning to look into this more seriously. You know, the issue about direct to consumer testing is a really interesting one because, you know, we do this. You can go into the drugstore and get a pregnancy test. Mm-hmm. It used to be, you know, that you couldn't do that and you couldn't get a pregnancy test until you went to the doctor. You know, you can go to the drugstore and buy a thermometer and check your temperature. But what was interesting is that if you think about it, pregnancy testing didn't get available direct to consumer until the characteristics of the test were pretty clear, that and that they developed tests that consumers could look at and say, "Yep, I'm pregnant," or "No, I'm not," and they were surrounded with warnings that said, you know, just because it's negative doesn't mean that you aren't necessarily, et cetera. So we do this already. I mean, people do a lot of things to assess their own health. But the idea of allowing a test of this complexity direct to consumer without any kind of built-in system for someone to interpret what it means is really a whole new thing. Mm-hmm. To give you another example that illustrates this, there was a fad about a decade ago about getting whole-body CT scans. Mm-hmm. Turns out that's probably not a good idea because the radiation's a lot. But most people can't read a CT scan, and so there had to be a physician involved. But the idea of just doing these tests and sending the information to people and sort of assuming that they can do something useful with it is pretty unlikely. So this isn't the same as, you know, the do-it-yourself pregnancy test.
Yeah.
It's really, really quite different.
Well, just to be clear here, where the concern is not over the accuracy of the test per se. That is, you get back a test result and it says that you have a particular gene. It's not that. It's the question is, well, when the person gets that piece of information, then how do they think about it? Do they understand it? What sort of value is it? What's the point of knowing that if that's all it is that you know?
That's absolutely the point.
Questions are certainly welcome. I'd like to introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Dr. Ellen Wright Clayton. She is professor of genetics and health policy, law, and pediatrics at Vanderbilt University. We're talking about genetic testing and some questions raised by direct-to-consumer tests. But then the larger question of genetic testing, who should think about this, what sort of value does it have, and how it is that people who are in the business of genetic counseling and also are physicians, how it is that they help people understand what that information means. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, I suppose that maybe then this would go to a very basic question. Given the very thing that you describe, the fact that we know that that there is this really complicated relationship between our genetic makeup and everything else that we're exposed to as we go through life, so that you can't necessarily draw a straight line between genes and disease. Given that there are, it's complex and it's uncertain, then one might ask, well, what value does genetic testing have any value at all?
Well, I think in some cases it most certainly does, and at various points in life and for various purposes. I mean, for instance, one of the oldest genetic tests that we've done in the United States, now going back really almost 50 years, is doing newborn screening, looking for certain disorders that, if they aren't treated right away, that they can cause irreparable harm to the child. And the, you know, the first one of these was a disease called phenylketonuria, which is one, or PKU. And the problem in that case is that there is an enzyme that's missing, which makes it impossible to deal with a particular protein component. And if you don't give them a low protein diet or a low phenylalanine diet, it will cause them brain damage. Now, you know, so that kind of thing is really pretty clear. Other things that are pretty clear are that there are mutations that are known to predispose people to develop various kinds of cancer, and that knowing that information may lead people to choose certain kind of medical interventions to avoid that cancer. The best example that I can think, I mean, there are a lot, but and most people talk about BRCA, but an even better one to talk about is that there are some hereditary forms of colon cancer that you can avoid the disease altogether if you remove someone's colon. Mm-hmm. But if you wait till they become symptomatic, they're going to get in a lot of trouble. Other things that we know are that there are certain kinds of genetic variants that affect the way people respond to medications. And so there are all kinds of efforts underway now to, you know, to begin to think about how to do that. So that you, when you start somebody on a medication, you, for one thing, can make sure that it's going to work, and two, are going to make sure that it doesn't have any toxicity. So to give you an example of that, there are about 10% of the population doesn't metabolize codeine. What that means is that you give them codeine for pain, as you might do after surgery or something like that, it just doesn't work because you have to metabolize codeine to make it work. And so, you know, you'd kind of like to know that. And there are many other examples of that, both avoiding, you know, to assess whether a drug's going to work or not, whether it's going to be toxic or not, other things of that nature. And I can tell you at Vanderbilt, we're shortly going to start a trial that, it's a pilot in our clinical care to, you know, to really think about how we're going to do this kind of testing for drugs that are very commonly used in adult medicine, like warfarin. So that's a reason. Other reasons people use genetic testing are to help them with their reproductive planning. Obviously, that involves a lot of, that is potentially controversial for a number of people, but certainly that is, that's a pretty common use of genetic testing. So the answer to your question is that there are a lot of reasons to use genetic testing, but you have to understand why the test is being used, you know, what the implications are, and what you're going to do about it.
So it all depends on what the quality of the information above and beyond just the simple test results. What's the quality of the information that the individual is going to get?
Right. Which, by the way, sort of characterizes most of clinical medicine. We do all kinds of things with patients, and the reason that we do them is because we want to detect problems that we can, you know, that we can deal with. So, you know, and they range from taking a history to doing a physical exam to doing blood tests, you know, for what people think of as ordinary chemistries to doing radiology. All of that is getting information that, you know, that is interpreted in the light of medical information to figure out what to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is just, I think this is really appropriately understood as, you know, another type of that kind of information that we use to, you know, try to help people make choices that are going to lead them to be healthier.
And is this truly a great advance beyond the kind of things that you could learn about a patient by having a thorough, detailed medical history that would include information about close family members and other diseases and conditions that they might have?
You know, that is a wonderful question. I'm really glad you ask it. It is amazing how important family history is and how amazing medical history is. One of the things that we teach medical students is that 95% of the information that's relevant to what you're going to find, you discover in the course of taking a really good history, and that includes a detailed family history. So I would say that you can get a lot of what you need by doing a really good family history. Now, there are some things that you can't get that way. So if you're in a family that is highly prone to a certain kind of cancer or some other thing, that the genetic testing may be necessary to figure out, you know, if there's a particular genetic variant that's running in the family and who doesn't have it. There is that role that absolutely has to be done with genetic testing. But the family history is going to give you a lot. And there's a really good reason why family history gives you a lot, because it gives you not only, you know, what the genetic variants are in your family, you know, because you have a 50-50 shot of getting, whatever genetic variants each one of your parents have, et cetera. But the other things that affect your health are also things that run in families, like what are your family's exercise practices? What do they eat like? Other things of that nature. All of that stuff runs in families. And also infectious diseases run in families because they're together, or many kinds of infectious diseases do. So I think that your question is a wonderful one. We don't do enough with detailed family history, sort of thinking that what we need to do is to do all this genetic testing. But the reality is, at least at present, you want to do a detailed family history because that'll give you an idea about where you need to look.
Yeah, and I suppose that also can sometimes be difficult, that it's not completely a matter of does the doctor have the time. One might ask, well, how really, what's the quality of information that the average person has about the health of the rest of their family? And, you know, what did Uncle Joe die of? And conditions like that might indeed be inherited. Maybe it's something that we also ought to be encouraging people to pay a little bit more attention about, too, so that when the time comes to provide the information, and in fact, it's the patient that's got to provide the information to the doctor. If the patient doesn't have it, well, that's not going to help.
Right. No, I think that is something that we ought to encourage, that we ought to encourage families to do. And obviously obviously what often happens when you're starting to look into a family who has a problem, that all of a sudden, you know, as you start getting into it, what's already existed within the family sort of, jumps out. Like, for instance, things that lead to early death in childhood, all of a sudden you'll find out that, oh, yeah, there were a lot of other, that in previous generations there were a lot of early deaths, things of that nature. There may be cousins or something of that. So, I mean, we ought to encourage people to do it. We need to be sensitive to the fact that this is information that not everybody has all the time, and, in fact, families often have secrets about this kind of stuff. But the point that is really important to make is that it's valuable. It's really valuable information to have.
I was thinking when you gave some really nice examples of cases where genetic testing could be very valuable information for people. And you could certainly see a case where, for example, if you could tell a woman that based on her genetic inheritance, she was at greater risk of developing breast cancer. Well, in that particular case, at the very least, that would help you decide what kind of periodic screening that woman should have throughout her lifetime. Or if you have someone and you could say to them, you could say to some brand new parents who have a little baby, you could say to them, you know, your child is at increased risk for, say, developing heart disease. So then you could start from day one to try to make sure that that child, as he or she grew up, had heart healthy diet and got good exercise, and you did everything you could to try and make sure they never started to smoke, and all of those lifestyle things that we know can lower your risk of heart disease. So in those cases, you can do something. But, you know, say, for example, that you could tell somebody that they were at increased risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. At this point, it seems that we really don't understand Alzheimer's disease very well. And for people who have Alzheimer's disease, there's not a whole lot at this point we can do for them. So then one might ask the question, you know, how many things are there that we could say you are at increased risk for developing a particular condition, but, you know, if that does develop, you know, there's not a whole lot we're going to be able to do for you. What's the value of knowing that?
Well, I mean, that's a really interesting question, and I think that the Alzheimer's issue is a really good example. I have to say that, you know, the most common factor that predisposes to the development of Alzheimer's disease is a particular variant called APOE4, and it turns out that that APOE is also relevant to heart disease, and so. So when in the 1990s, people began doing APOE testing as part of a cardiovascular workup, and then they found out that people were sort of getting surprised with the news that they actually had an elevated risk of developing Alzheimer's disease, which they didn't very much like. What's happened since is that actually the introduction of statins has meant that we've stopped testing for APOE as a part of a cardiac workup because, in fact, statins are so terrific as a class that, you know, there was no need to go for sort of genetic targeting there. What's interesting is that actually there's a wonderful study that's been going on at Boston University now for a number of years called the REVEAL study, which shows that people who want that information, you know, do pretty well with it. They have some stress immediately, but then they kind of get over it. And I was just talking with the investigator yesterday about this, that part of the reason that they kind of get over it is that the information is still rather probabilistic in the sense that even if you have two copies of APOE4, you still are not certain to get Alzheimer's. You just have an elevated risk. So that's nice that people who want the information, who may want it, you know, to think about because they just want to know or because they want to do life long-term care or, you know, something of that nature, that they do pretty well with it. But, you know, other people don't want to know. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really interesting example about how you think about that. And, you know, is the goal of giving people information so that they just know, or the goal of getting them information so they can do life planning, is that within the realm of what the medical system ought to be doing? I think that's an open question. But it's very clear that at least getting testing for something like that ought to be a matter of choice. Well, all these things ought to be a matter of choice, but it ought to be particularly a matter of choice because it's unclear exactly what to do to avoid becoming sick.
Well, and there, I suppose, again, in that particular case, we're talking about Alzheimer's disease. It is my understanding at this point now that the only certain way to make a diagnosis of Alzheimer's is postmortem. Is after a person is dead and take a look at their brain. So I suppose someone really would you could make the argument that before a person was dead, long before a person was dead, at the point where you'd have the opportunity to do any intervention at all that was possible, if you got a heads up that this person was at greater risk of developing Alzheimer's, well, that would be all to the good.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that's going to change. I mean, we're going to figure out how to diagnose Alzheimer's disease before death. You know, with a high degree of certainty. I mean, one of the things that makes this whole area so interesting is that it changes, you know, on a daily basis. You know, when the breast cancer genes BRCA1 and 2 were defined in the early, or identified in the early 1990s, we really didn't have much of an idea about what you could do to avert disease in people with these mutations. But as a result of clinical trials, a variety of other things, we have a much better idea what to do. You can't prevent the disease risk altogether, but you can minimize it to a very large degree. So, you know, so the recommendations that, you know, were being made in the, you know, in the early 1990s, you know, and people didn't really know what to do, well, now they have a whole lot better idea what to do. I think we're going to have the same thing happening with Alzheimer's disease. We're going to have, you know, better diagnostics so that you can diagnose it before death. You know, eventually we're going to come up with therapeutics that make a difference. You know, as with many things, that's a long slog. And, you know, one of the things that you learn in medicine is humility, because, you know, often you can define a disease and then it can take a really long time to come up with an effective cure. But once you do, then your whole thinking about this changes. So what I will say today about what kinds of things are clinically indicated is going to be very different in a year. And I know that, and I anticipate that. So, and that's just a part of our practice.
We are just a little bit past our midpoint, and I have a caller, and I would like to introduce again the guest. We're speaking this morning with Dr. Ellen Wright Clayton. She is the Rosalind Franklin Professor of Genetics and Health Policy. She's also Professor of Law and Professor of Pediatrics at Vanderbilt University Law School. She's particularly interested in things like law and genetics, and also the way that law, medicine, and public health all come together. She's done a lot of writing on those subjects. She's also been an advisor to the National Institutes of Health and also other federal and international organizations on a range of topics ranging from children's health to the ethical conduct of research that involves human subjects. And we're talking this morning about genetic testing and what sort of things that can tell us, who can benefit, and how do you want to approach that. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You also can send your comments and questions along by email to will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have someone in Belgium to talk with right now here on our line four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I'd like to bring up an aspect of what you're talking about that's probably a little bit different, maybe not what you want to talk about, but let's give it a shot. You've been skirting around, and you have spoken a lot about the moral and ethical aspects of getting these tests and finding out early whether you're going to die from some horrible, horrible disease. But given the medical situation in America today, with health insurance the way it is and health costs being the way they are, and just the way we live in our lives, you know, wouldn't it be wise if they get these tests, that once you have your children raised and you've got yourself fairly well set in life where you're going to be, you're in middle age like Mr. Inge and I, isn't really that the time when you should be taking more risk in your life? And you say, well, why should I even bring that up? Well, one of the worst things that I can imagine is to outlive my ability to pay for my health care. So if I take the risk now, and maybe I do die from bungee jumping or whatever, but at least I'm not going to die in some hospital tied up to a million machines bankrupting my family.
Well, thank you for that. Thank you for that question and comment. Let me respond to you this way. One of the debates that I think we are really that we are having, certainly in this country, and I think in many other countries around the world, is, you know, how ought we to think about about the end of life and how, you know, and how hard ought we to, how hard ought we to push to extend life, say, for another month or two with some of these highly expensive therapies, and things like that. I think that we really need to have, first of all, let me say that there are a number of people who make the choice not to push that hard and increasingly say, you know, what I want to do at the end of my life is that I think I've run my race and the time is to go peacefully. My mother made that decision last year. She was diagnosed with lung cancer and decided not to get therapy. And it had really a very peaceful end. It was really pretty marvelous. On the other hand, I think, you know, many people fight very hard. And I think that I think that there are reasons that people do that. I mean, in part because they value their own lives. Oftentimes it's because relatives can't bear to let them go, other things of that nature. I think the solution to that question has got to be, you know, a sort of a personal and a social debate about, you know, how do we think about our lives? How do we think about the ends of our lives? And I can tell you that a lot, you know, I see a lot of what you're talking about as well, but I also see a lot of people who are turning to hospice and who are turning to, you know, and who are turning to say, you know, I've done what I'm going to do, and I want, you know, an end that is comfortable, that is with my family, and things of that nature. So, genetics doesn't, I mean, this is obviously not the topic of this particular session, but I do think that there's hope in having this kind of social cultural discussion that leads people to say, you know, I've lived my life, I've done well, and it's time to stop. And we kind of have gotten away from that in recent years. But I certainly see a lot of people who are making that decision.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, let's go on to another caller here. This is now someone local. We're here where we are in Champaign, and it's line one. Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
Let's see. I have a question, and it may be that the current health insurance legislation makes this at least partially moot. But, I mean, I like the idea of genetic testing, but, for instance, let's pick Alzheimer's disease. Let's say that I get genetic testing and it shows that I have a probabilistic predisposition towards Alzheimer's. And let's say that then for whatever reason I'm going out and trying to buy health insurance or I'm trying to get a new job or I'm doing something where if the other party had that information or if I was sort of legally required to come forth with that information, it might make a difference. I might have to pay a lot more money, or I might be not denied a situation that otherwise I wouldn't be denied. How is the issue of privacy and genetic testing and health insurance and so on? How is that all going to play out?
Thank you for that question. I mean, that's a really great one, and I have some good news and some bad news. The good news is that in 1998, Congress passed the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. Congress had actually, in the 1990s, as part of HIPAA, which is mostly what you think of as a privacy act, actually had said that genetic information could not be used to deny you access to health insurance. At least at that time, they didn't say anything about rating. Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act did two really important things. One is that it said that it couldn't affect the rate, that genetic information couldn't affect the rate that you pay for health insurance. Hugely important. Second thing it said was that genetic information couldn't affect your access to a job. So both of those are true. Here's the sort of less than good news. One is that this is particularly relevant in the case of Alzheimer's, is that it doesn't apply, that the limit on use of that kind of information doesn't apply to either life insurance or long-term care insurance.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
And the other thing that it doesn't apply to is when you become symptomatic, even for health insurance or employment. So for health insurance, you know, once you become symptomatic with Alzheimer's disease, then you, you know, then you fall into the regular rules. Now, we have the health care reform, which is going to make that, which is going to make the health insurance part much better. Going to make that go away. The employment part, then you're going to fall into the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the inquiry is going to be, if you have early onset Alzheimer's, can you still do the job safely? And if you can, then you can have your job, and if you can't, then you can't. So, but the important thing to think about with regard to genetic testing for Alzheimer's is that once you do it, then, you know, then that information can be used in, you know, in defining your access to long-term care insurance and life insurance.
Uh-huh. Well,
and you know, and here, so here's another thing, just to go a little further with this. So, you know, and so they, those insurers can ask you, they can ask you a couple things. One is they can ask you your family history. And, you know, so if you have lots of Alzheimer's disease in your family, then that's going to come out. And they can also ask you if you've ever had any genetic testing and what it was about. So that's the current lay of the land. I think for access to health insurance, things are a lot better. For ability to have access to jobs, things are a lot better. For the other things, they are not a lot better.
Okay, that's very interesting and quite helpful, and a lot of what you told, some of the things I knew, but a lot of what you told me was new information, and I appreciate it. This is a great subject and an important one, so thank you.
All right.
Great.
Well, thank you.
My pleasure.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. We're talking about genetic testing and what it's all about, what it can tell us, who maybe should think about it, what then needs to happen in terms of counseling and what kind of information people should get in addition to those test results. And we're talking this morning in this hour with Dr. Ellen Wright Clayton. She's a professor of genetics and health policy, law, and pediatrics at Vanderbilt University. And questions are welcome. We have, as I say, about 10 minutes left. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to go back again. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that that your genetic makeup is just one part of what determines who you are and what kind of diseases and conditions you might develop, and it has some predictive value, but you might have to go on a case by case basis. And I don't know if it's possible to answer a question like this, but when we're talking about, say, so we're talking about predictive testing, and we are saying to someone that you have a chance of developing a particular kind of cancer or heart disease or Alzheimer's or diabetes or, you know, some long range of things, is it possible to say, well, what we're really saying is you have a 90% chance or a 50% chance or a 20% chance, or is it actually possible to fine-tune it to that point?
Sometimes. And let me just say, sometimes, you know, you can say things with certainty.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and oftentimes you can, you know, come up with a number that is, you know, pretty close to accurate, or at least a range that's pretty close to accurate. So, but again, it oftentimes requires looking not only at what your particular genetic variants, but also other things in your life, other diseases that you have, exposures you may have had, your family history. And so I think that it turns out to be complicated. On the other hand, yes, they can sometimes get pretty darn close. Some people with mutations in BRCA1 have a 90% lifetime risk of developing breast cancer. Others of them have about a 50% chance, and those distinctions can be made.
All right, let's talk with some other callers. And we have another champagne person here, line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure I've got a couple of the basic facts of the discussion straight. Do I understand that this matter was sort of brought to attention because Walmart was proposing to sell genetic testing method somehow to the public?
It was Walgreens.
Walgreens.
Actually, and well, I'm just saying for us here on this is what got us thinking about it, was that there were stories in the Chicago Tribune, a lot of other newspapers across the country, about the fact that Walgreens had said they were going to start testing, they were going to start selling these over-the-counter genetic tests, and that concerns were raised by the FDA and by also, various kinds of healthcare organizations that raised some questions about, knowing that, then what benefit is that information? What sort of additional information should people have? Should people have some help in determining, well, what do you do with that information even if you get it? Essentially, that was our jumping off point for thinking about it and wanting to talk about it.
Okay, and about how recent were these stories in the paper?
About a month ago.
Okay, and is Walgreens going ahead with its plans?
No.
Oh, they stopped?
They stopped.
Because of the FDA inquiry?
Well, I think because of the FDA inquiry, and also because they got a lot of adverse publicity about it.
From medical sources?
Well, I think I would say the media were pretty negative about it, but there were a lot of medical sources who were not very happy about it either, that's for sure.
And what precisely is the nature of the objections?
Well, there are a number of objections. One of them is that people would get the information and wouldn't know what to do with it. Another concern, and they wouldn't know what to do with it, and so then they would go and, and then try to ask their family physician or other people to try to figure out what it means. I think that was a concern, and that it would lead to a lot of anxiety and a lot of additional medical testing.
Okay. It's interesting, in the context of a situation where for many years now it has been widely accepted that drug companies can advertise on television to people who, by and large, I think it's safe to say, are not equipped to assess the nature of the content of the advertisements. And they go to the doctor and ask for things. I find it strange that the proposal to give people a choice to get information that it would then be their responsibility to try to understand is somehow sufficiently objectionable as to try to make it stop, or to prevent it. That seems strange in the United States. Does it not seem strange to you?
Well, I understand the analogy that you're making, and I think that one of the issues that many people have thought about direct-to-consumer pharmaceutical advertising is that it is a not insubstantial driver of healthcare costs in this country. But I think so. The distinction that you're trying to say is, why is it okay that pharmaceutical companies can advertise drugs, at least the safety and efficacy of which we know? But limit the availability of direct to consumer genetic testing. Where I would argue that the safety and utility of which we don't know.
What kind of danger is there to it?
Well, the danger to it is that it leads to a whole lot more use of resources, which all by themselves include a not insubstantial amount of not only cost but also adverse events.
I see. In Europe, as best you know from being familiar with this area, what seems to be in the immediate pipeline? That is to say, Walgreens made this proposal, the FDA and others have objected. What seems to be the likely course from here?
I think that's an interesting question. And I think, so here's an argument that I would say to give you a counter to sort of frame this in a way that may make a little bit more sense, or not more sense, but may affect how you see this. I mean, the fact of the matter is that one of the roles of the healthcare system is to figure out how best to use diagnostic and therapeutic interventions to help patients. It's the reason that you can't go out and get an MRI just because you want one, or that you can't go out and, I mean, there are any number of diagnostic and therapeutic interventions that you can't get just because you want it. And so I think what's going to happen is that this is actually causing a clash of actual norms of healthcare practice, which is to say, you know, are we going to enter an era in which patients can get whatever it is that they want at any time that they want it, regardless of the consequences potentially adverse of getting the information? Or are we going to say that when you're getting health-related information that you need to do it in the context of a healthcare setting where just because you ask for an intervention, what the physician's job is to help you decide whether the intervention is appropriate or not. I mean, it really falls exactly into that paradigm. And so, you know, so what's coming down the line with genomics? You know, we're going to have whole genome sequencing soon. And so, you know, is it going to be the case where everybody is going to be able to, you know, go get their whole genome sequence and then make their own decisions about what medical interventions they want, or is this going to be a mediated system where this kind of technology is implemented in the context of the healthcare system? I mean, that's what's coming.
I hope the caller will forgive me for jumping in because we're getting very short on time. But this is a question that I definitely wanted to get at, whether you think that we're going to get to the point where this testing will be accessible enough, will be inexpensive enough, so that at least for people who have health insurance, is this going to turn out to be something that's just routinely done for everyone, and that everyone will get this, and in fact, we'll get a printout that will have this long list of things that they should be thinking about?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question, and a lot of people say yes. My own view about this is that what I would actually sort of prefer to see is that we do the whole genome sequencing, and then it be put in a repository that is accessed on a need to act basis. So, to give you an example, we already do this with the electronic medical record when we give drugs. If somebody's on a different drug, at least in my hospital, they get a notice saying you don't want to give this drug because this person is already on. You don't want to give drug X because they're already on drug Y. We will soon have the system in place where we're going to say, you know, you don't want to give the drug X in A dose because they have a genetic variant, which means they need to be on B dose. I think we'll have a system where if somebody shows up with symptoms, that the query will say, oh, gee, this might be affiliated with this particular disorder. I am not sure that it's going to be, in fact, I'm fairly confident that it would not be good public policy to just give everybody a readout and say, you know, go at it. I think that would have a tremendous number of adverse consequences, just even within the healthcare system. I'm not even looking to the larger society.
And just real quick, like in about 30 seconds, do you think that as time goes along, there will be more and more medical therapies that are tailored to an individual's genetic makeup?
You bet.
Well, that, a good short answer to the question. There we're going to have to finish up. Our guest, Dr. Ellen Wright Clayton, is professor of genetics and health policy, professor of law, and professor of pediatrics at Vanderbilt University Law School. And Dr. Clayton, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. It was my pleasure.